Chapter 29. He respected his honor more. Hereupon the captain sat down, leaving the whole vestry much affected. Mr. Tittypot instantly rose, and was received with the same encouragement. He likewise said, and the exquisite art of this orator communicated to the observation an air of freshness and novelty, that he too had every respect for that vestry, that he too had every respect for that chair, that he too respected the honorable and gallant gentleman of Wilderness Walk, but that he too respected his honor more. Hosever, apostrophe added the distinguished vestryman, if the honorable and gallant gentleman's honor is never more doubted and damaged than it is by me, he's all right. Apostrophe Captain Banger immediately started up again, and said that after those observations, involving as they did ample concession to his honor without compromising the honor of the honorable gentleman, he would be wanting in honor as well as in generosity, if he did not at once repudiate all intention of wounding the honor of the honorable gentleman, or saying anything dishonorable to his honorable feelings. These observations were repeatedly interrupted by bursts of cheers. Mr. Tittypot retorted that he well knew the spirit of honor by which the honorable and gallant gentleman was so honorably animated, and that he accepted an honorable explanation, offered in a way that did him honor, but he trusted that the vestry would consider that as Mr. Tittypot's honor had imperatively demanded of him that painful course which he had felt it due to his honor to adopt. The captain and Mr. Tittypot then touched their hats to one another across the vestry a great many times, and it is thought that these proceedings, reported to the extent of several columns in next Sunday's paper, will bring them in as churchwardens next year. All this was strictly after the pattern of the real original, and so are the whole of our vestry's proceedings. In all their debates, they are laudably imitative of the windy and wordy slang of the real original, and of nothing that is better in it. They have had strong party animosities, without any reference to the merits of questions. They tack a surprising amount of debate to a very little business. They set more store by forms than they do by substances. All very like the real original. It has been doubted in our borough whether our vestry is of any utility. But our own conclusion is, that it is of the use to the borough that a diminishing mirror is to a painter, as enabling it to perceive in a small focus of absurdity all the surface defects of the real original. Our bore, it is unnecessary to say, that we keep a bore. Everybody does. But, the bore whom we have the pleasure and honor of enumerating among our particular friends, is such a generic bore, and has so many traits, as it appears to us, in common with the great bore family, that we are tempted to make him the subject of the present notes. May he be generally accepted. Our bore is admitted on all hands to be a good-hearted man. He may put 50 people out of temper, but he keeps his own. He preserves a sickly solid smile upon his face, when other faces are ruffled by the perfection he has attained in his art, and has an equable voice which never travels out of one key or rises above one pitch. His manner is a manner of tranquil interest. None of his opinions are startling. Among his deepest-rooted convictions, it may be mentioned that he considers the air of England damp, and holds that our lively neighbors, he always calls the French our lively neighbors, have the advantage of us in that particular. Nevertheless, he is unable to forget that John Bull is John Bull all the world over, and that England with all her faults is England still. Our bore has traveled. He could not possibly be a complete bore without having traveled. He rarely speaks of his travels without introducing, sometimes on his own plan of construction, morsels of the language of the country which he always translates. You cannot name to him any little remote town in France, Italy, Germany, or Switzerland, but he knows it well, stayed there a fortnight under peculiar circumstances. And talking of that little place, perhaps you know a statue over an old fountain, up a little court, which is the second no, the third stay yes, the third turning on the right, after you come out of the post house, going up the hill towards the market? You don't know that statue? Nor that fountain? You surprise him. They are not usually seen by travelers. Most extraordinary. He has never yet met with a single traveler who knew them, except one German, the most intelligent man he ever met in his life. But he thought that he would have been the man to find them out. And then he describes them, in a circumstantial lecture half an hour long, generally delivered behind a door which is constantly being opened from the other side, and implores you, if you ever revisit that place, now do go, and look at that statue and fountain. Arbor, in a similar manner, being in Italy, made a discovery of a dreadful picture, which has been the terror of a large portion of the civilized world ever since. We have seen the liveliest men paralyzed by it, across a broad dining table. He was lounging among the mountains, sir, basking in the mellow influences of the climate, when he came to Unipiccola Chiesa, a little church, or perhaps it would be more correct to say Unipiccolissima Cappella, the smallest chapel you can possibly imagine, and walked in. There was nobody inside, but a cieco, a blind man saying his prayers, and a vecchio padre, old friar, rattling a money box. But, above the head of that friar, and immediately to the right of the altar as you enter, to the right of the altar? No. To the left of the altar as you enter, or say near the center, there hung a painting, subject, Virgin and Child, so divine in its expression, so pure and yet so warm, and rich in its tone, so fresh in its touch, at once so glowing in its color, and so statuesque in its repose, that Arbor cried out in ecstasy, "That's the finest picture in Italy." ... And so it is, sir. There is no doubt of it. It is astonishing that that picture is so little known. Even the painter is uncertain. He afterwards took Lum, of the Royal Academy. It is to be observed that Arbor takes none but eminent people to see sights, and that none but eminent people take Arbor, and you never saw a man so affected in your life as Lum was. He cried like a child. And then Arbor begins his description in detail, for all this is introductory, and strangles his hearers with the folds of the purple drapery. By an equally fortunate conjunction of accidental circumstances, it happened that when Arbor was in Switzerland, he discovered a valley of that superb character, that Chamouni is not to be mentioned in the same breath with it. This is how it was, sir. He was traveling on a mule, had been in the saddle some days when, as he and the guide, Pierre Blanco, whom you may know, perhaps, Arbor is sorry you don't, because he's the only guide deserving of the name, as he and Pierre were descending, towards evening, among those everlasting snows, to the little village of La Croix, Arbor observed a mountain track turning off sharply to the right. At first he was uncertain whether it was a track at all, and in fact, he said to Pierre, "Qu'est ce que c'est donc, mon ami?" What is that, my friend? Ooh, monsieur. ... said Pierre. Where, sir? ... There. ... said Arbor. Monsieur, si n'est rien de tout, sir, it's nothing at all. ... said Pierre. Allons. Make haste. Illinois V.I. Nijit, it's going to snow. ... But, Arbor was not to be done in that way, and he firmly replied, "I wish to go in that direction, G.V.Y. Aller. I am bent upon it, Jesus determined. En avant. Go ahead." ... In consequence of which firmness on Arbor's part, they proceeded. Sir, during 2 hours of evening, and 3 of moonlight, they waited in a cavern till the moon was up, along the slenderest track, overhanging perpendicularly the most awful gulfs, until they arrived, by a winding descent, in a valley that possibly, and he may say probably, was never visited by any stranger before. What a valley! Mountains piled on mountains, avalanches stemmed by pine forests, waterfalls, chalets, mountain torrents, wooden bridges, every conceivable picture of Swiss scenery. The whole village turned out to receive Arbor. The peasant girls kissed him, the men shook hands with him, one old lady of benevolent appearance wept upon his breast. He was conducted, in a primitive triumph, to the little inn, where he was taken ill next morning, and lay for 6 weeks, attended by the amiable hostess, the same benevolent old lady who had wept overnight, and her charming daughter, Fanchette. It is nothing to say that they were attentive to him. They doted on him. They called him in their simple way, Lane Janglis the English Angel. When Arbor left the valley, there was not a dry eye in the place. Some of the people attended him for miles. He begs and entreats of you as a personal favor, that if you ever go to Switzerland again, you have mentioned that your last visit was your 23rd, you will go to that valley and see Swiss scenery for the first time. And if you want really to know the pastoral people of Switzerland, and to understand them, mention, in that valley, Arbor's name. Arbor has a crushing brother in the East, who, somehow or other, was admitted to smoke pipes with Mehemet Ali, and instantly became an authority on the whole range of Eastern matters, from Harun al-Rashid to the present Sultan. He is in the habit of expressing mysterious opinions on this wide range of subjects, but on questions of foreign policy more particularly, to Arbor, in letters, and Arbor is continually sending bits of these letters to the newspapers, which they never insert, and carrying other bits about in his pocketbook. It is even whispered that he has been seen at the Foreign Office, receiving great consideration from the messengers, and having his card promptly borne into the sanctuary of the temple. The havoc committed in society by this Eastern brother is beyond belief. Arbor is always ready with him. We have known Arbor to fall upon an intelligent young sojourner in the wilderness, in the first sentence of a narrative, and beat all confidence out of him with one blow of his brother. He became omniscient, as to foreign policy, in the smoking of those pipes with Mehemet Ali. The balance of power in Europe, the machinations of the Jesuits, the gentle and humanizing influence of Austria, the position and prospects of that hero of the noble soul who is worshipped by happy France, are all easy reading to Arbor's brother. And Arbor is so provokingly self-denying about him. I don't pretend to more than a very general knowledge of these subjects myself, says he, after enervating the intellects of several strong men, but these are my brother's opinions, and I believe he is known to be well informed. The commonest incidents and places would appear to have been made special, expressly for Arbor. Ask him whether he ever chanced to walk, between 7 and 8 in the morning, down St. James Street, London, and he will tell you, never in his life but once. But, it's curious that that once was in 1830, and that as Arbor was walking down the street you have just mentioned, at the hour you have just mentioned, 7:30 or 8:20. No. Let him be correct. Exactly 8:15 by the palace clock he met a fresh-colored, gray-haired, good-humored-looking gentleman, with a brown umbrella, who, as he passed him, touched his hat and said, "Fine morning, sir, fine morning." William IV. Ask Arbor whether he has seen Mr. Barry's new Houses of Parliament, and he will reply that he has not yet inspected them minutely, but that you remind him that it was his singular fortune to be the last man to see the old Houses of Parliament before the fire broke out. It happened in this way. Poor John Spine, the celebrated novelist, had taken him over to South Lammeth to read to him the last few chapters of what was certainly his best book, as Arbor told him at the time, adding, "Now, my dear John, touch it, and you'll spoil it." And Arbor was going back to the club by way of Millbank and Parliament Street, when he stopped to think of Canning, and look at the Houses of Parliament. Now, you know far more of the philosophy of mind than Arbor does, and are much better able to explain to him than he is to explain to you why or wherefore, at that particular time, the thought of fire should come into his head. But, it did. It did. He thought, what a national calamity, if an edifice connected with so many associations should be consumed by fire. At that time there was not a single soul in the street but himself. All was quiet, dark, and solitary. After contemplating the building for a minute, or, say a minute and a half, not more, Arbor proceeded on his way, mechanically repeating, "What a national calamity, if such an edifice, connected with such associations, should be destroyed by a man coming towards him in a violent state of agitation," completed the sentence, with the exclamation, "Fire!" Arbor looked round, and the whole structure was in a blaze. In harmony and union with these experiences, Arbor never went anywhere in a steamboat, but he made either the best or the worst voyage ever known on that station. Either he overheard the captain say to himself, with his hands clasped, "We are all lost," ... or the captain openly declared to him that he had never made such a run before, and never should be able to do it again. Arbor was in that express train on that railway when they made unknown to the passengers the experiment of going at the rate of 102 miles an hour. Arbor remarked on that occasion to the other people in the carriage, "This is too fast, but sit still." ... He was at the Norwich Musical Festival when the extraordinary echo for which science has been wholly unable to account was heard for the first and last time. He and the bishop heard it at the same moment and caught each other's eye. He was present at that illumination of St. Peter's, of which the Pope is known to have remarked, as he looked at it out of his window in the Vatican, "O Silo! Questa cosa non sera fatta, mai ancora, come questa, O heaven! This thing will never be done again, like this." ... He has seen every lion he ever saw, under some remarkably propitious circumstances. He knows there is no fancy in it, because in every case the showman mentioned the fact at the time, and congratulated him upon it. At one period of his life, Arbor had an illness. It was an illness of a dangerous character for society at large. Innocently remark that you are very well, or that somebody else is very well, and Arbor, with a preface, that one never knows what a blessing health is until one has lost it, is reminded of that illness, and drags you through the whole of its symptoms, progress, and treatment. Innocently remark that you are not well, or that somebody else is not well, and the same inevitable result ensues. You will learn how Arbor felt a tightness about here, sir, for which he couldn't account, accompanied with a constant sensation, as if he were being stabbed, or, rather, jobbed, that expresses it more correctly, jobbed with a blunt knife. Well, sir, this went on, until sparks began to flit before his eyes, water wheels to turn round in his head, and hammers to beat incessantly, thump, 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 all down his back along the whole of the spinal vertebrae. Arbor, when his sensations had come to this, thought it a duty he owed to himself to take advice, and he said, "Now, whom shall I consult?" He naturally thought of Callow, at that time one of the most eminent physicians in London, and he went to Callow. Callow said, "Liver." ... And prescribed rhubarb and calomel, low diet, and moderate exercise. Arbor went on with this treatment, getting worse every day, until he lost confidence in Callow, and went to Moon, whom half the town was then mad about. Moon was interested in the case. To do him justice, he was very much interested in the case, and he said, "Kidneys." ... He altered the whole treatment, sir, gave strong acids, cupped, and blistered. This went on, Arbor still getting worse every day, until he openly told Moon it would be a satisfaction to him if he would have a consultation with Clatter. The moment Clatter saw Arbor, he said, "Accumulation of fat about the heart." ... Snugglewood, who was called in with him, differed, and said, "Brain." ... But what they all agreed upon was to lay Arbor upon his back, to shave his head, to leech him, to administer enormous quantities of medicine, and to keep him low, so that he was reduced to a mere shadow, you wouldn't have known him, and nobody considered it possible that he could ever recover. This was his condition, Sir, when he heard of Jilkins at that period in a very small practice, and living in the upper part of a house in Great Portland Street, but still, you understand, with a rising reputation among the few people to whom he was known. Being in that condition in which a drowning man catches at a straw, Arbor sent for Jilkins. Jilkins came. Arbor liked his eye, and said, Mr. Jilkins, I have a presentiment that you will do me good. Jilkins' reply was characteristic of the man. It was, Sir, I mean to do you good. This confirmed Arbor's opinion of his eye, and they went into the case together, went completely into it. Jilkins then got up, walked across the room, came back, and sat down. His words were these. You have been humbugged. This is a case of indigestion, occasioned by Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.